From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Hard to believe, but summer school starts today for kids in Detroit. We'll talk to the superintendent of public schools in the city.
It was just great to see teachers back in classrooms with students.
And we're checking in with one parent as she reflects on how systemic racism filters down to kids.
That manager could not see a family striving to raise their child right. All they could see was an inevitableness of that child going astray and becoming a criminal.
Writer Des Cooper shares her family's experience. And if I asked you to picture what COVID-19 looks like, I bet you'd think of a spiky red ball floating in space. There are people whose job it is to think about visualizing the biomedical world.
We actually react to those images very viscerally. Like we see an image of bone marrow and it's absolutely beautiful.
Those conversations coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we're going to talk about the way that systemic racism demands that Black boys and girls grow up fast.
I really think it's not the fear of Black boys in particular being criminals. It's the fear of the righteous anger that Black people feel being turned against whites.
That's coming up a little bit later in the show. But first, today was the first day of summer school in Detroit. Since there has never been a school year like this one in living memory, it may be that there has never been a summer school year like this one either. With us to discuss what's happening in July, August, and all the months beyond is Nikolai Vitti, superintendent of Detroit Public Schools Community District. Nikolai Vitti, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us a little bit about how many kids came for classes this morning and what they found when they got there?
You know, let me just start off by saying this is far from easy. I'm starting to call this the new normal. There's a lot of angst. It's legitimate, a lot of concerns. But what we're trying to do as a school district is meet our parents and students with where they are. After the spring shutdown, a lot of our parents, a lot of community members just continue to ask me, what are you going to do differently to try to catch our children up, knowing that they fell behind? And one of the things that we said we would do is expand summer school and give parents the option of face-to-face or online learning. And then if we had employees that were willing to do face-to-face instruction, then we would provide that. So we asked our parents, 4,000 parents said they wanted summer school. Half wanted face-to-face, half wanted online. Then we had to ask teachers, would they be willing to do it? Not required. We needed 170 teachers. 300 signed up to do it. So today was our first day. We had about 500 students show up face-to-face. That number may actually be higher by the end of the day today and into the week. But 500 showed up at about 20 buildings. And I was able to visit them, and it is a new normal. We had all of our students wearing masks. Most came to the school today with a mask. They were dropped off with a mask or came off the bus with a mask on. From what I saw, it was just great to see teachers back in classrooms with students. But again, this was far from easy, and there's a lot of people in the community that have legitimate concerns about a return, but I thought about it long last night. I prayed about it last night and this morning, and I said, I'm going to go to schools and see what I see and talk to people. And overall, when I left school, I felt like we made the right decision and we're going to keep on pressing forward.
I need to ask you about something that happened before class began this morning. Some protesters blocked a driveway used by the district's buses. They say that they're concerned about the coronavirus. They were holding signs and some were placing tree branches on the ground to try to stop the drivers from leaving to pick up kids. Do you know how many kids might have been prevented from getting to summer school today?
Yeah, unfortunately, we may have had 300 students that would have possibly been picked up, possibly, because we don't know how many would have actually used a bus. But we had about 5 schools that were impacted due to the protests, about 275 pickup spots, if you will, were not picked up. And then most unfortunately, the bus terminal where the protests were held was the bus terminal where those buses would serve our most medically fragile children. We are going to make some changes to our bus schedule starting tomorrow. We intend to pick up our students and continue with school. And we reached out to those parents to let them know that the buses would not move forward in that area, mainly southwest Detroit and the west side of the city today, but we'll continue tomorrow.
What do you make of the criticism that some of the kids attending classes, and maybe also some of those who are pioneering distance learning from home, are being treated like guinea pigs in this moment?
Yeah, so I'm not interested in treating any one of our children as guinea pigs. That's not my intent at all. In fact, if parents did not sign up for face-to-face learning, then we wouldn't provide it. The whole structure of summer school this year was meeting parents and students where they are at and employees that were willing to serve them. We're not doing this randomly. We're abiding by CDC's reopening of schools guidelines, the American Federation of Teachers guidelines, Michigan's safe reopening of schools, the governor's return to learn task force guidelines and recommendations. So none of this is being done randomly. In fact, the strategies that we're implementing are probably the most stringent, rigorous safety strategies that you're going to see throughout the country all put together. But our children are not guinea pigs. This isn't about, testing what we can or can't do. This is about meeting a demand of parents.
What have you heard from parents about why in-person instruction is important to them?
Oh, many reasons. Online learning did not work for all children in the spring, and I don't think it'll work for all children in the fall. That's why we're trying to propose a hybrid approach for the fall, where parents will have the option of either face-to-face learning or online learning. But back to your question, just a lot of parents aren't situated based on their own education, their own comfort with directly teaching in at home. Now, they're not directly teaching, but they're obviously supporting. And they're saying that their children are frustrated, that they're frustrated. That's why we have certified teachers. That's why we send children to school, because there are experts that are working with them on a day-to-day basis in reading, math, science, social studies, and the electives. And parents, not all of them at least, are in a situation to support their children. So one, just parents feel inept. They feel frustrated, and they know their children aren't learning at high levels. For other parents, they're just not in the socioeconomic situation to be at home, and they need the school system to provide the education and child care so that they can work. For other parents, they realize that socially, students are falling behind. They're depressed. They're isolated. They're not connected to goals, to structure, and they see their children suffering from that and not having those opportunities.
What metrics are going to be informing your decisions in the months to come about whether classes can indeed resume as planned?
Well, obviously, any guidance from the federal level, and I say that only because I feel like I have to. I think the federal government has failed miserably addressing COVID nationally and then specifically in this conversation, education. So I don't expect much to happen from the federal level. If anything, it'll be punitive around funding if we're not fully open and without a hybrid approach. So I say that because I feel like I have to say it, but I don't expect anything necessarily coming from the federal government other than punitive steps if certain things don't happen. But we're going to rely mainly on the state, mainly the governor, to decide the phases of reopening and the phases of safety. And if we remain in phase four, then we believe that we can provide face-to-face instruction. But that needs to be coupled with online learning. Not all of our parents, not all of our students, and not all of our employees will feel comfortable face-to-face, and we're going to work through the demand side of what parents and students need, coupled with the number of teachers that will need to either do face-to-face or online. But this is going to be a difficult process, but the summer school portion is a part of that process. It's phase three of reopening for us. Phase four will be fall reopening. But there's certainly many more questions that need to be answered, mainly at the state level, on whether they're going to allow online and hybrid. Is it going to be fully funded? Are there repercussions for teachers not coming back to work? What are protections for those teachers that don't want to come back to work? What does the actual budget look like beyond hybrid? How much of a cut are we going to see? There's so many questions involved right now. And then, probably most importantly, what is the status of COVID throughout the nation, in the state of Michigan, and in the city? Are we going to see increasing cases, more deaths? And that's going to influence, I think, decisions made in the future as well.
Do you worry about a situation in which perhaps if the caseloads become high again in the fall, and if Governor Whitmer were to say, we're not going to hold in-person classes for schools, that then the federal government might retract funding or might withhold funds? Is that a concern for you?
Absolutely. There is nothing that's coming from the executive branch right now that is reasonable, that's thoughtful, that's strategic, that's reflective of how people feel right now. It sounds political. There's a line in the sand that's drawn saying that we must go back to school face to face, and there's not even a plan for that. So even if that's how the president felt was the right thing to do, then that needs to be funded. It needs to be communicated. There needs to be a strategy behind it. But we're not even hearing or seeing that. So yes, I am afraid that that kind of approach will continue. And there will be threats of defunding. Obviously, the court system can be used against that. Hopefully, state government can be used as a buffer for that. I'm optimistic that here in Michigan, the governor and the legislature are listening to parents, listening to school districts, and that something more balanced will come out. I do believe we need to do face-to-face instruction, but I also think that we need to do online learning, and we can empower parents and students to make the decisions that they feel is best for them, rather than pigeonholing themselves to one decision or the other.
Nikolai Vitti is superintendent of Detroit Public Schools Community District. Dr. Vitti, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The images of the new coronavirus, translated from microscope data, have appeared before millions of eyes. Those images were molded with some intention. We're going to think about images of COVID and how they work as artifacts of design after a break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Here's a little secret about the media business. Whenever there's a big breaking story, reporters start working fast, trying to get interviews and background information, and folks in charge of the digital end of things are working just as hard to find images to accompany the story. And sometimes, I'm sure you've noticed this, there are stock images that come up again and again, especially if there's something exciting and resonant about those images. We've been looking at the image of the COVID-19 virus that has accompanied so many stories that we're sure you've seen in the past few weeks and months, and we've been wondering about its qualities. Deborah Gamuccio is Professor Emerita of Cell and Developmental Biology at the University of Michigan, and she's also the director of something called the Bioartography Project that takes images from researchers' science and converts them into beautiful works of art. She has some thoughts on COVID and its depiction and joins us now. Deb Gamuccio, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you very much for having me, April. It's a delight.
Will you tell us a little bit about how some of the images that we see of something as tiny as a virus, how those images are made?
Well, they're actually structurally pretty accurate. So the first images that are taken are typically of viruses using an electron microscope, which is something that can magnify things much greater than even a typical light microscope can. This particular virus is, I think it measures approximately 100 to 120 nanometers, and a nanometer would be one millionth of a millimeter. So for example, a human hair is about 75,000 nanometers. And so that would mean that you'd need a little over 600 virus particles to span the width of a human hair. So that's how tiny it is. You have to see it under electron microscope. And there, under those kinds of scopes, all the images are black and white. And they're a little bit fuzzy as well. So what the artist did was took pretty much the shape of what they saw under the electron microscope and then added some colors and a little bit more detail to make it look striking as an image. So those big red spikes that you typically see, those are really there. You can see those in the electron microscope. And those are actually part of the virus particle that attaches to cells and allows the virus to gain entry to the cells. And then they put on a bunch of other little colored dot on the virus envelope that you can see. Those are just representing various proteins. So that you really, the real virus doesn't have any color. It's pretty much just transparent. But the image gives you the impression of an entire thing that has some, you know, some substance to it that you can grab, that you can mentally deal with.
So if I'm getting you, the virus itself, the structure that we see is pretty accurate, but it's the color aspects in this case that are, shall we say, man-made.
That's right. That's right.
What do you observe in people's reaction to this image? My 10-year-old took one look at it and was like, oh, it's a poof ball.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've heard everything from, you know, speck of dust type thing to alien spaceship. They have made it in the dark red colors give it kind of a sinister look, at least to me. And as I've heard other people react in the same way. In this case, the image is just an image of the virus, but I'm not sure how much the branding or the use of the image has helped the people understand more about the virus and what they can do to avoid it.
That's a lot to unpack there. First of all, I know that when a virus is named, there's a great deal of thought put into what the name should communicate about it. There has been an interest in recent years not to demonize places around the world which may or may not have anything to do with the virus's origins. Are you saying that there is some intention given to how representations of the virus should look and what they should tell us about it?
Yes, I think there is emphasis on how it should look. But what I guess I'm saying here is that when I look at that image of the virus, I see those red spikes as most prominent. And talking about names, the name comes from those red spikes. They look like a crown in the electron microscopes. So corona is the word for crown, right? But when you look at that particular image, I don't think the image by itself tells the people much more than, oh, this is an approximate indication of what the virus actually looks like. What could be conveyed if there was more, let's say, verbiage typically done with the coronavirus presentations, is they could say, okay, those spikes are made of protein. That protein dissolves in soap or hand sanitizer. If you wash your hands and use hand sanitizer regularly, you can get those viruses, you can kill the viruses, basically.
Is there any chance at this point for us to, shall we say, alter? I mean, is the brand ripe for a reboot? Are there ways that, you know, future generations of imagery around COVID could possibly communicate that information?
It's possible. Even, for example, if you took that and then put a few words around the virus that just said, destroy this protein or something, wash your hands, destroy this protein, something that would give people a little bit more information about how they can defeat it.
How do you think the shape of it, how do you think it works as a sort of artifact of design?
Well, I think, again, it's quite an accurate depiction of what the virus is. And if many people are actually getting more adept at going online and finding out things, and certainly you can go online and learn a little bit more about the coronavirus. You can learn, for example, about these spikes and how they are the way that the virus gets into the cell. You can learn it that the whole envelope of the virus is made up of protein, and that protects the so-called brain of the virus, which is just a single strand of nucleic acid, in this case, ribonucleic acid. And that's what the virus is using to tell the cell to make more of itself. So you can go online and you can learn these kinds of things. The representation doesn't necessarily tell you much about that. It does give you the sense of what the virus looks like. It does give you this sense of reaction, either a fuzzy ball, which is a little bit scary to me. I wouldn't want to hug my virus, or an alien spaceship, which might be a little bit more fearful in most people. But it doesn't tell you more about the biology of the virus. It doesn't tell you how tiny the virus is. The image actually gives you an impression it's fairly large.
Right.
Because it has a lot of parts on it, right? But it's not.
Let's talk a little bit about how bioartography has taken certain images and made them go viral in a little bit different way. For those who don't know the story, could you tell us about the origins of the project?
Well, sure. Thank you. It was started back in 2005. Sue O'Shea, who's a professor of cell and developmental biology, and Kim Lim, who's an assistant professor in cell and developmental biology research track, and I were kind of daydreaming one day about the fact that we had so many beautiful images that we take on a daily basis, but we had never used those images. We actually react to those images very viscerally. Like we see an image of bone marrow and it's absolutely beautiful. And so we were saying, well, what would happen if we took these images and we matted and framed them and sold them as art and then used the money as a fundraiser to help our trainees travel to meetings and meet with their peers and be able to present their work and network. And so that kind of the idea took off. And for the very first years, we actually did all the matting and framing ourselves. We got into the Ann Arbor Art Fair, and about 40 volunteers every year would help us man the booths and sell everything. But then what we realized from that is that the images are not just good for fundraising. They're also this amazing tool to communicate to the public the newer aspects of biomedical research, answering questions like, why is it reasonable to use a fruit fly to study human colon cancer or Down syndrome? What are human embryonic stem cells and how are they being used and why should we not be afraid of them? So there's a lot of information we can give, both with the image, but in our case, in contrast to the coronavirus, every one of our images is sold with a paragraph which tells about the image and its implications, and a little bit about the research project that underlies the actual taking of that image under the microscope.
You mentioned bone marrow. Do you have other favorites?
Oh, well, my favorite's in the intestine. It's gorgeous. And I've studied it most of my research career, so I guess I can't. That's my top favorite. The brain, of course, neurons in general, neurons come in all kinds of shapes, sizes. They communicate with other cells. And I guess for me, one of the central messages here is communication. Communication that we can do with the public, communication that cells do to each other, communication that the coronavirus does to our cells and things like that. So to me, communication is kind of the central hub here.
I couldn't help but notice that bioartography has taken advantage of the moment by adding a line of masks to its product list. Can you tell me what some of the what some images were that you chose for the line of masks?
Right. Well, we're exploring this territory. The background here is that we had some help from Christiane Myers, who's actually in the School of Theater and Music at Michigan. And she and I held a joint project last summer, which involved making silk scarves. We sold those at the art fair and did quite well. So Christiane suggested this year that we should make masks. And she has fabric artists that can help, and she helped us get this all in line. We chose two images for starting out the project, one of which is actually a fetal lung of a mouse, which kind of shows how the air spaces are growing together with the capillaries, because in the end, your lung has to be really, really close to your blood, your air spaces have to be very close to your blood capillaries, and this starts in fetal life. And the other one is actually a picture of some bacteria. Those particular ones happen to be cyanobacteria. So they're not really something that we breathe in the air, but the mask does look like it has bacteria swarming all over it.
Are these not the same ones that lead to toxic blooms in the lakes in the summer?
They are. They exactly are. Those are fascinating bacteria because they actually fix over 50% of the carbon dioxide in the air. And we don't know how they do it. So the bacteria are smarter than we are, just like the virus is. And so people at the University of Michigan, Anthony Beccarelli in the in molecular cell and developmental biology department is studying those bacteria quite avidly to try to understand how they fix carbon dioxide. And he's where we got the images from.
Well, I have to tell you, I don't know if I'm ready to put the bacterial image so right on my face. It's just a little too nerve-wracking. That one with the alveoli is really beautiful. I'm going to opt for that one. Have you had many takers on the mask line?
Well, we've sold about two-thirds of almost three-quarters of our stock that we got in the first round. And we're putting in another order for more material. So, yeah, it seems to be doing pretty well.
Wow. Can you tell us a little bit about how creativity comes into the process of making images like this?
Oh, at many points. So when you think back, these are images, for example, that we have are all images taken during the course of research. So research is basically a creative process. You take a lot of facts that are known, and then you try to jiggle those facts and put them together in a different way and project what might be a new truth. And to then test whether that new truth is correct or not, you do experiments. And the microscope is one way that you visualize the results of your experiment. So there's a whole creativity in planning. Then there's the creativity in how you take the picture under the microscope. You want to show carefully what your anomaly is or what your normalcy is in some cases. And you have to be very careful about how you take your images. And then finally, in the case of us, we do manipulate those images further using Photoshop. And we try to make them even more striking so that they'll grab the eye of the public. And we have help with that because what we do is manipulate a bunch of images. We make multiple versions and we take them to artists in the art school and they pick out the most striking images. And so those are the ones that we always go with every single year. So at multiple stages, there's a creative process going on that in the end is the image that you see in bioartography.
Deb, I think a lot of people have this erroneous idea that scientists don't really use much creativity in their work. What is it like for the folks who've been collaborating on bioartography to have this outlet?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I guess the first part of the statement I think is outright wrong in terms of the way people think about scientists. As they think about scientists, they think about data. And it's true that data forms the basis for our understanding of things. But to get to the next step, to go beyond what is known and what the data tell us now, to project what the data might mean for a fact that we don't yet know. That's what the creativity is all about. We have to come up with ideas in our brain to think about what this data might be telling us, that it's not there on the page, but we have to put it together in a different way and become creative. And then we can design experiments to test whether our various creative ideas are right or wrong. So it's science is absolutely all about creativity. On the other hand, what bioartography does, I think, is utilize that creativity to communicate to the public.
Deborah Gamuccio is Professor Emerita in Cell and Developmental Biology at the University of Michigan and Director of the Bioartography Project. Deb, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, April. I really appreciate it. Please stay safe.
You too. Coming up, writer Des Cooper talks about the day she marched her mischievous 9-year-old into a store and made him confess to shoplifting, and what happened as the store manager called the cops.
We tried to console our traumatized child. In the process of teaching him about justice, we'd almost gotten him arrested.
Des will tell you the full story after a break. We hope you can stay to hear it. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This summer, along with much of the rest of the country, we're spending some time thinking about systemic racism, what it looks like, the ways we've noticed it in our lives, the ways that we sometimes have overlooked it in our lives. This week, we're talking about education and kids. And today, we wanted to get to a truth that you don't have to tell families of color in America, and that's that boys and girls in these families, and most frequently Black boys and girls, are often perceived as somehow older than their actual ages, somehow more irresponsible, sometimes less emotionally mature, and ultimately more threatening than white kids in the same age group. Writer and Michigander Des Cooper has some thoughts on this. She lives in Virginia Beach these days looking after her folks, but she wrote an essay recently in The Rumpus that illuminates her family's particular experience. Joining us from Virginia Beach, Des Cooper, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate your being here today.
The article that you wrote is called Arrest Record, and it lays out a particularly harrowing experience you had with your son Jay when I think he was about 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Will you read for us?
Sure, I'd be glad to. In the years before Netflix, my husband and I used to take our son and daughter to Blockbuster on Friday nights to rent a movie for the weekend. It became our family ritual, especially in the winter months when the Michigan evenings fell so early. We drive to suburban Detroit. There were no Blockbusters in the city in those days. Grab a movie and then go out for dinner. Increasingly, what started out as a pit stop to launch the weekend became a tug of war at the checkout. Instead of heading for the rows of movies, our elementary schooler swarmed the junk aisle, begging for everything except movies, Disney tie-in toys, candy, magazines. Well, one evening, when our son Jay was about 10, he was adamant about getting an action figure. When we told him to put it back and get a movie, he tried to bargain for a toy instead of a movie. We held the line. He glumly picked out a movie, and we headed for the car. As soon as we got outside, he started to giggle, and then he pulled out the action figure from beneath his coat. Now, there's a theory about Black parenting. They say that we punish our children harder, louder, more physically than non-Black parents as a remnant of slavery. It's like broken windows parenting. You come down hard on the small infractions to prevent bigger infractions that could become a matter of life or death. I don't know how true that is, but we did make a giant mountain out of a molehill that evening. We yelled at Jay for shoplifting and fumed that he had purposely disobeyed us. It was time for a lesson. We marched him back into the store to return the toy and to apologize to the owner for what he'd done. He was big for his age and too big for this kind of behavior, but he started to cry. Ignoring his tears, we asked for the manager, a middle-aged white man. In between his teary gulps, Jay confessed to his crime. "We are so sorry," I said, heaping on the apologies. "This will definitely never happen again." The manager glared at us. "I'm calling the police," he said, picking up the phone. "Wait, what?" My husband stepped toward him. "What are you doing?" "I'm calling the police. He was shoplifting." We hustled out of the store and piled into the car, not hanging around to see if the man actually called the police. My husband and I kept checking the rearview mirror, expecting the wail of a siren at any moment. We tried to console our traumatized child. In the process of teaching him about justice, we'd almost gotten him arrested.
That's Des Cooper reading from her essay, Arrest Record. You can read the entirety of it online at The Rumpus right now. Des Cooper, there's just so much there for really any parent to latch onto and be completely grieved by. What in the world do you think that Blockbuster manager was thinking?
Oh, well, you know, part of me wants to say you need to ask him, like be cocky, but I know exactly what he's thinking. He had seen all of the reports of how Black men were rampaging in Detroit and how dangerous Blacks were. He had completely absorbed all the stereotypes. And what makes it very interesting for Black families is that we realize very often we are reminded that we aren't different than a stereotype. Like sometimes people feel like they've risen above their circumstances or the circumstances in their communities. I have a friend who is an attorney for ExxonMobil in Houston. And in recent times, he's had white coworkers come to him and say, "Man, you know, this is crazy what's happening out here. It's a good thing that's never happened to you." And he's like, "What do you mean?" "Yeah, that happened to me."
Is there a question mark at the end of that sentence?
No question. Yeah. It's like, and I do think that people feel that sometimes their Blacks are honorary whites. Like, those Blacks do that, but my Blacks don't do that. The ones that go to church or the ones with me or the ones that live next to me or the ones that work or who are my best friend. But the world does not make that distinction. And I think that that's exactly what was happening. And not only were we all caught up, I mean, come on, the parents brought the child back into the store and made the child apologize. There is no way that this kid was not in a supervised, loving environment, trying to teach him moral lessons. And that manager could not see a family striving to raise their child right. All they could see was an inevitableness of that child going astray and becoming a criminal. That's all he could see.
It's hard to imagine that essay capturing even more emotional resonance, but you go right ahead and do that as you continue to talk about, you know, maybe what Jay took away from that situation and how he came to understand himself as the object of so much animus as really just a boy. And you go on to write about a photo shoot you were part of that involved Jay and a pair of handcuffs that really rocked you both emotionally. Do you mind telling us about that?
Well, this was, you know, not many years apart from, or months even, from when the shoplifting episode happened. Nathaniel Abraham was a notorious criminal, quote unquote, in the Detroit metro area. He's a Pontiac boy who shot a teenager and was charged as an adult for murder at the age of 11. It was at a time where the United States was afraid of the super predator, the wave of Black and brown boys in particular who were going to rampage across the country and make the world unsafe for all of us. And so there was a lot of punk prisons, of mandatory sentencing, and the lowering and lowering and lowering of ages where young people could be treated as an adult for a crime. And Nate was the first to be charged under this law in Michigan. I was working at the Metro Times at that point and was caught up in the story, especially because Nate and my son were a year apart in age. And I just had a hard time imagining this happening to my child. And of course, as a Black mother, I could and almost had to imagine that. While other people would say that would never be mine, I had to say, what if it were mine? When I did the story, we did the photo shoot, and I was clear that I wanted a young black boy in handcuffs holding a teddy bear on the cover. Like, this is the image I had. But what black mother could I ask to borrow their son to shoot that? I mean, I could not go to anybody and do that. So we talked about it and decided that Jay could do the shoot. And at first, Jay, this is also sort of the early days of hip hop, rap, you know, he was not immune from all of that culture pouring into his life. So I think he thought, you know, whoa, thug life, especially since he was a big old nerd, and this would be totally fun to be a tough guy. And when we got to the shoot, as soon as those handcuffs clinked, I just, oh my gosh, my heart is beating right now, just sort of going back to that moment. And he was okay, but then soon he was like, can you take these off? Like, it just wasn't fun. It was very uncomfortable. They kind of hurt. And I was like, take it off, take it off. And so we took the cuffs off and he played with the photographer, who is one of the best people I know. And he got us both calmed down. But I just never shook that. And I remember saying to the photographer, so I can't help but think, if Jay ends up in handcuffs for real one day, will he remember that it was his mother who first put him in handcuffs? Mm.
As we review the stories in just the past decade of young black boys being killed by police or people who claim to be acting in the interests of security, where the justification is that the boys were mistaken for being older than they were. I mean, this is a list of boys, including Tamir Rice in Cleveland, who was 12 years old, mm-hmm. playing in a park when police shot him. How does that understanding of how white America views black children, how does that resonate with you today as a mother? And you're a grandmother at this point, too. Mm-hmm. How does that land?
The same way it landed when I was the sister of a brother. Of a baby brother in the 60s. I mean, we have never not been terrifying. It's always not our potential as human beings, but our potential as criminals that people see first. And that has not changed. And ironically, you know, there's this saying, you become what you fear. And I really think it's not the fear of black boys in particular being criminals. It's the fear of the righteous anger that black people feel being turned against whites. I mean, the fear is in them, right? And it's being projected onto our children. That's what's happening. And that's not going to get shook loose until the guilt of what has happened to black people in America is owned by whites. I mean, there's got to be a boogeyman and it can't be them. So, boom, you know, black men are it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Des Cooper. She has a recent essay available at The Rumpus called Arrest Record. Des, given all you know about how society works for black boys and what you wrote, you still hold on to some optimism that the structure and people in positions of power will come to view and treat Jay and other sons justly and fairly, perhaps even when that's not actually the case. What do you think it is within us that makes us need to trust other people?
I'm not sure it's even fair characterization for me to say I believe it will change, because everything has taught me that it's probably not, and it's going to be a long time more coming. I think, though, there is the hope of transcendence. The hope is that a few of us will get through. And a few more and a few more. You know, I don't want to sound heroic, but it's almost the Harriet Tubman hope. It's like, okay, I'll go back one more time, and this time it'll be solved. So I think that is more the hope. I mean, you can't give birth to someone and then give up hope. I mean, you can, but that is not what is in me as a parent. You know, I think immediately you start living for the future when you give birth to someone. You immediately start trying to figure out a better path for them in particular and for the world in general, for them to have it better. So I think that's what keeps it fighting. And then ironically, they keep coming. So you got grandchildren. I mean, how many of us have said, well, at least let me live to see, you know, my kid graduate. And then you go, well, let me live for marriage. Then let me live for my grandchildren. Right. Then let me see them graduate, you know. So you never want to stop, you know. I mean, that's a human survival mode. That's what we do as humans, is that we want to be here for the next and the next. And Black families are the same as any family in that regard. So the hope is not really so much like I'm gonna make a magical wish or unicorns or rainbows or even prayers to heaven that things are going to change soon or in my lifetime. It's that they're here and I care and I love so fiercely that I will get up every day and pray that it will be different through my actions. You know, through my actions, something will change. You know, now we wake up and we see those young people in the streets. And I will say it's been quite a funk to experience a pandemic of disease and a pandemic of racial unrest at the same time. But for the racial unrest, I think I would have been far less hopeful, because the pushback has been so enormous and so broad that it's make me feel like, oh, okay. You know, we really aren't by ourselves, and we really aren't going to let leadership get by with this. And we really are going to address some really deep-seated issues. And I know this isn't going to be a seismic leap, but it already has been seismic. It's just that we have so far to go that it's just the beginning. But to go from everything's A-okay to we should rename our schools and our hospitals and we should rethink about history and we should take away racist depictions on our breakfast products, you know, that's a pretty big awakening. So I'm hoping it will continue.
Do you feel like you've come to a different place in how you coexist with your worry for him?
No. So we are quarantined together here in Virginia.
You and Jay. Yeah.
Yeah. And so on top of all this, we've watched Black men being murdered together and the response to that every day, all day, because we're quarantined and there's really nothing else to focus on. And I've watched his very sweet demeanor get sullen and quiet, him disappear in his room. And I worry about his mental health. One day he said, you know, I'm going for a drive. And I literally wanted to jump up and say, no, I'll take you. But I couldn't. Someone's got to stay with my parents. And then I wanted to say, well, don't go right now. It's too close to dark. I mean, I was literally in the middle of this saying, no, my baby is going to get hurt. Don't go out there.
Yeah.
So no, it's the same from the beginning. It's worse now because I can't control him.
You started a Facebook group in the middle of all the protests surrounding George Floyd's murder. And the name of the group is How We See Us. It is the most lovely roll of pictures of Black men and boys just in their lives as seen by their families and their friends. Could you talk a little bit about starting the page?
You can't see me, but I'm grinning from ear to ear. Like when I just think of some of the pictures that are on that page.
They're just so lovely.
It's just boys and men and fathers doing what they do. They're like falling asleep with a baby slobbering all over their stomachs. And they're laughing on the Detroit Zoo train. And they're
karaokeing in the car with their daughters. And, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it's like, where do we ever see this? Especially if you're not already tied to African Americans and their families. Like if it's not showing up in your feed, where would you actually ever see that? You wouldn't see it anywhere. You know, we show up when there's trouble. And so I just wanted to have a page where we could just post what our real lives look like. And they are not 24 hours of stress and violence and gnashing of teeth and wailing. You know, we're living and we're enjoying our children and we're enjoying our families. We are enjoying our men. They love us and we love them. And it's very hard to even keep that in mind as Black people sometimes. So I just wanted to have a place where that's clear.
Des Cooper, thank you so much for the many, many things that you're putting out in the world, whether it's the pictures, the words, just all of it. And thank you for talking with us about what's going on with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Writer and Michigander Des Cooper coming to us from her quarantine spot with her family in Virginia Beach. That's our show for today. Stateside is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and Mercedes Mejia. The executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.